When we talk about bees, usually we mean honeybees or maybe bumblebees. But that's just two. You know how many different kinds of bees there are in the world? 20,000. I mean, that's more species than all the birds and all the mammals put together. Conservation biologist Thor Hansen dreams of one day seeing them all. And if you're thinking that maybe sounds a little bit dull,
no, bees can be just as colorful as anything in your bird book. You can have bees that have red hairs or shiny red bodies. You can have bees with fuzzy blue hairs like the carpenter bees of Indonesia. One of my favorites is something called the alkali bee, which has these stripes that, if you look closely, are shimmering with rainbows because the structure of that surface of the bee scatters light just like the surface of an opal.
Is that the one that you wrote about? You said it looks as if it's made of light?
It does look that way. You can hardly focus your eyes on those colors. They just seem to shift and move as if the bee were made from light itself.
Oh, that's just magical.
These little flying jewels that surround us, we just need to slow down and pay attention to them.
Bees must go way, way, way back for that many different kinds to have evolved.
All the way to the age of the dinosaurs, the mid-Cretaceous period, about 120 million years ago. Bees evolved from wasps. There had been wasps around for millions of years. But the wasps are inherently hunters and scavengers. They're constantly scouring the landscape for other insects or spiders or scavenging bits of meat.
So they're carnivorous.
They are carnivores at heart. Bees evolved from the wasps by developing a dietary habit. They became vegetarians, provisioning themselves solely from the products of flowers.
We should call them floritarians.
Well, a good way, a silly but good way, honestly, to think of the evolution of bees and to remember all the key steps is to think of them as hippie wasps.
Flower children.
They are the flower children of the wasp tribe, if you will, in that they are long-haired flower lovers.
120 million years ago means that bees are actually older than humans, which means humans must have evolved right along with bees. Did they interact much?
This is a wonderful question, and it goes straight to the heart of some new research that is fascinating to me. And that is, if you look at the hunter-gatherer people living in East Africa, particularly the Hadza tribe, you find that they are incredible honey hunters, scouring the landscape, the savanna, for bee nests and beehives. But it wasn't until quite recently that anthropologists decided to ask the question, well, how much honey do these people eat? And they found that it was a full 15% of the Hadza diet.
That's a lot.
It is a lot of honey, those calories all coming from honey. And it becomes particularly interesting in an evolutionary context.
How come?
Well, because the story of human evolution has always been a story about brain size. And the brain is what physiologists like to call metabolically expensive. It takes a lot of energy to run the brain.
Is that because it's big compared to so many other species' brains?
It's because it is metabolically active. Before your cup of coffee in the morning, your brain is busy and taking up a lot of energy. And so to evolve a larger brain, you need to be able to fuel it. And when we look back at human evolution, every time we see in human ancestors some large increase in brain size, anthropologists have always tried to link that to some increase in calories. An example would be the invention of better tools for hunting and gathering, or the mastery of fire for cooking, which frees up more calories from food. All of those things are thought to have helped boost brain size. So what's interesting about this honey hunting example is that anthropologists are now asking, well, would our ancestors have done anything else? They would have loved honey too, and would have been subsisting in the same area, doing basically the same things. No one's saying, I should say, that honey made us human, but that it could have contributed to the increases in brain size over our evolutionary history.
So when people talk about the decline in the bee population these days, there's a term for it, right? The beepocalypse. And it goes with this really scary scenario that the bees are dying or going extinct. And that means the world's crop supply is going to crumble and eventually humans will starve to death. Is that just dystopian fantasy or is that really likely to happen?
Well, this idea of the beepocalypse has definitely caught our imagination, in part because we're so dependent upon bees for so much of our food supply. I mean, people often say that every third bite of food is reliant in one way or another on bees. But there is some good news from all the research that's gone on, and the good news is this. We know enough to take action. So we do now see some encouraging signs where people are trying to bring flowers back into rural landscapes that have lost them, or planting bee gardens in backyards and even in urban areas. And we see that bees do respond to restoration efforts. And that is perhaps the most encouraging thing.
You tell this wonderful story about a small community in rural Washington that's kind of modeling what a truly pro-bee lifestyle might look like. Can you tell us about that?
The town is Touchy, Washington. It's in the dry eastern part of the state, and they have a tradition of growing alfalfa for seed, and you cannot make alfalfa seed without bees. But what's peculiar about alfalfa flowers is that the flower parts are packed together so tightly in the petals at the center of the flower, that when the bee comes in to access that pollen and reach the nectar, the flower parts bonk the bee right on the head.
Hmm.
And honeybees can't stand it. They won't put up with it. So they're crummy pollinators for alfalfa. So the farmers in this rural community noticed generations ago that there was a little bee accessing their alfalfa fields just from the habitat surrounding them. And these little bees didn't mind getting bonked on the head at all. In fact, they seemed to thrive on this alfalfa pollen and nectar. And so they followed the bees back to where they were naturally nesting, and they found them along the edge of the river in these sort of salt pan areas. These were a species of bee called the alkali bee, and in fact, they're a bee that we mentioned earlier in the interview with these shimmering, pearly, opalescent stripes. They're just a gorgeous little bee.
The ones that look like flying light.
The ones that look like flying light, these little jewels. And they followed them home, and they found that the bees were nesting underneath these salt crusts in these flat areas. So they came back to their farms and they decided that, well, we can make that habitat right here next to our alfalfa fields. It is probably the only place in the world where you can find farmers purposely salting their fields. They go out with thousands of pounds of rock salt and cover the ground in bee beds next to the alfalfa fields. And the last time anyone bothered to count, there were an estimated 18 to 25 million female alkali bees nesting in those bee beds alongside the alfalfa. It's the largest aggregation of native bees measured any place.
And you wrote that it's not just the farmers, it's like the whole community is really aware of how dependent they are on bees. You wrote that during droughts, people will skip showers and let their lawns die just to keep the water for the bees.
Isn't that marvelous? But it's true. The whole community now understands how important those bees are to the local economy, to the point where the road department is involved. You drive into that valley and you come up next to an alfalfa field, and here's a road sign that drops the speed limit from 50 miles an hour down to 20. And right underneath that sign is a very standard road sign that says alkali bee area.
It's a bee safe zone.
Yeah, it is a bee speed zone.
I mean,
you drive slow in Touchy to save the bees.
I really love that. So my question is that kind of thing, people coming together to support this tiny insect. Is that happening in other ways in other places? I mean, would you say that we're seeing a kind of renaissance of people reaffirming their connections to bees?
I like to think it's beginning. And I like the fact that you say renaissance, because I really believe that in learning about bees, we are also undergoing an act of remembrance. Because we have this ancient, ancient connection to bees, it's really only over the past few generations that we have become distanced from them. So I do believe we have an inherent connection to and curiosity about these creatures. And I find stories like Tushy or some of the bee restoration efforts and studies going on across North America and also in Europe and other places extremely encouraging.
Has working with bees affected you at all emotionally, personally?
Well, I mentioned earlier that I have always looked for ways to chase after these creatures in daily life. And I would say that they have become a part of the rhythm of life for me and really in my family, in that we look for bees. We notice them now in ways that we didn't used to. And seeing the first bumblebee of the season is a big event for us. It's a symbol of that rebirth and the springtime where we might have once listened for the birds singing. Now the bees are a part of it. And I think we can all participate in that rhythm.
Thor Hansen is a conservation biologist and the author of Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. I love taste of honey.